Serving the planet. The Micro Effect.
www.themicroeffect.com.
You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
A mighty nation, blessed above all of creation. It was a rare and precious pearl, conceived in faith and liberty, home of the brave, land of the free. It was the envy of the world. But this shining city on a hill has turned from the Creator's will and let evil take control. Now the reckless men who lead them want to strip away their freedom and to steal their very souls. Now it's smoke and mirrors, switch and bait, criticize and confiscate, and let the guilty walk away. In this once righteous, godly nation, in the halls of education, they forbid a child to pray. They say we need to spread the wealth. They pretend to guard the health of the feeble and the poor. While the hand they hold behind their back confuses and conceals the fact that the wolf is at the door. There's an unseen hand that pulls the strings.
Well, good morning, America, and welcome to Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel. It's a beautiful Tuesday morning, March 26th, and today we have a guest who is going to tell us exactly what natural law, what our founding fathers intended, and what natural law and common law really are, and why it's so important that we retain the type of legal system that our founding fathers envisioned for this nation. And we're going to have a fun discussion today. My guest today is Brent Allen Winters, and Brent has written a number of books, but the one that we're going to be talking about primarily today is The Excellence of the Common Law, and that book is really an interesting book. It's fascinating. It's a big book. It's 760 pages, something like that, but it is really a history of where our legal system came from and what the other legal systems around the world are now and why they are that way, and really define why we need to go back to what our founders envisioned for this nation. So with that, Brent, welcome to the show. I want you to give a little of your background and tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself.
Well, thanks, Dan. Of course, it's great to be here, and I appreciate all the pieces you invite me. My name is Brent, as you said, and my middle name is Allen, and my last name is Winters. I use all three because there are other Brent Winters around, I've discovered, and if you type in those words, you can go to Amazon and find books and things of that nature. I think there's even some audio resources there, but my name is Brent. I'm from back near Terre Haute, Indiana, and I grew up on a farm there. My father worked in the oil fields when I was growing up and farmed, and as time went on, he began to farm more, and he finally got out of steam and in the oil field, and we went to raising livestock more and more, and time came, finally, my brother left home, and I left home, my older brother. There were four boys in the family, and I served in military service for over a dozen years, and I went to school, and I studied hard. I wanted to be a geologist. My dad worked in oil patch. I wanted to work in the oil patch. My father wasn't a geologist. My father wasn't formally educated. I didn't go to high school, but he worked in the oil field and knew what he was doing. He teamed in the oil field for years and did very well. But I wanted to work in the oil field. Well, I got involved with that and ended up, though, not working in the oil field. Ended up out west working in hard rock mining. And I got involved with another fella in a mine operation. And I didn't realize it. I grew up in cornfields more than hard rock mining. But I found out that it was just like the oil field. Once a fella thinks he's got the rights to minerals, everybody and his brother thinks they've got the rights to them too, and they'll come and say so and file lawsuits against you. My partner at that time was the same age as my father. He's now passed away, and he was from Kansas, and he said, Brent, if we're going to continue doing this, one of us probably ought to go to law school, and I could guarantee you it's not going to be me. So I ended up trying to go to law school, and I didn't have anybody to bankroll me, but my partner, he did help me when I got the pinch, because I had a family by that time. As a matter of fact, had six children by that time. And so it was a matter of financial ability to do it, but somehow I got through a year, and then I ran out of money, went back out west, and got involved in more mining, and then gathered my money up a little more, went back and finished, and I've been practicing law now for quite a while. And that's what I do now, among other things. But what I love more than anything, of course, is to be productive. And if I had my way about it, I'd be back home now farming. That's the way life works, I suppose. We realize that in the end, what's really important, and I know that law is important, and it's important to us in more ways than we can understand. It sets the tone for all of our lives, all of our possible fortunes or lack thereof. Law is simply what is right and what is wrong. And whoever you deem to be your final arbiter of right and wrong in individual instances from whose decision there is no meaningful appeal, that's your lawgiver. And historically, such a person or such a thing, if you're foolish enough to take a created thing, such as a man or a priesthood or an idol or one of the heavenly bodies as your lawgiver, or the movements of the heavenly bodies, any created thing, living or dead, if you take that as your final arbiter of right and wrong, in individual instances from whose decision there is no meaningful appeal, that's your God, could be yourself. If you're foolish enough to do that, God help you. There are many that do. Matter of fact, I think more people do that than trust the true lawgiver, as James says, for right and wrong. But the true lawgiver has given us two volumes of right and wrong. Two volumes. These and no other, these and no more, our country and our organic documents, the Declaration of 76, to begin, cites both of those documents as our most fundamental law. The first volume is unwritten, and the second volume is written. Our founding document called the Declaration of 76 calls them the laws of nature, and second, the laws of nature's God. The first volume, the laws of nature, is unwritten. The second volume, the laws of nature's God, is written. That's the Bible. You say, how do you know, Brent? Well, I know it because I can go back about that time, about the time of 1776, and I can read Bill Blackstone's commentaries on the laws of England, popularly called the Commentaries on the Common Law, and he says in the first volume that that's what those words mean. At his time, he says that's what that means. The laws of nature are the laws of nature around us in creation, the way things work, a matter of physics, a matter of the natural world. What goes up must come down, the law of gravity. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Those are laws of nature. That's the first volume, and it's not written. It's something meant our Maker reveals His will through those laws, meant to be observed and to be followed. And if you don't follow them, you'll starve to death. That's why the farmer plants in the spring and harvests in the fall. Now, if the legislature in your state comes along and says, we're not going to allow any more planting in the spring, we're going to make sure, and the law is now you've got to plant in the fall. Well, if you do that, you're denying God's will, His laws of seasons and nature. And people will suffer accordingly. Well, that's the first volume. Then our Declaration of 76 says there's a second volume, the laws of nature's God. And William Blackstone, the great jurist that has been so influential on not only our country now, but the folks that founded our country. More copies of Bill Blackstone sold in America of 3 million souls, by far the sold in England of 8 million souls. And no authority was quoted more in America through the 1890s, from the beginning of our country through the 1890s, no one quoted any authority more than William Blackstone's commentaries. There's an important reason for that. And we can go back and see, and in that book, by the way, there's a section, the book you mentioned, Excellence of the Common Law, there's a section on Blackstone's commentaries, and we know how many copies sold in the colonies because we can go and get the orders and the booksellers and find out who got them. And it is true, in America, people were by far and away, even more than England, interested in their common law tradition. Well, the common law tradition being that first volume, The Laws of Nature. Well, that second volume, The Laws of Nature's God, is the Bible, says William Blackstone. It's written, and it's particular. It tells us right from wrong. And those two volumes reveal the will of God to man. There are no other volumes. There is no other source. These and no others. These and no more. You say, well, Brent, even though William Blackstone says that, how do you know that's true? Well, I know it's true because John Locke said so. Now, John Locke, of course, said Tom Jefferson, the fellow that was the chief drafter of the Declaration of 76, our organic law is declared there. Tom Jefferson said that John Locke was one of the three greatest men that ever lived. Not that he was Jesus Christ, but he's a great man. And John Locke, to understand our country, we need to understand him. He was an Englishman. And he was an incurable fan of the Scottish Enlightenment. Incurable. And the Scottish Enlightenment, of course, arose out of the Scottish Reformation. Scottish Reformation, chief personality in those days, was John Knox. The Scottish Reformation established in Britain, along with the Puritans in England, the absolute authority of that second volume called The Laws of Nature's God, the Bible, as from the true lawgiver, the only true lawgiver, that person from whose decision there is no meaningful appeal in individual instances. That's our God. He is lawgiver. Those words, the words translated God mean lawgiver, Elohim of the Older Testament, Theos of the Newer Testament. And John Locke was the son of a Puritan lawyer, And his father said, I want this boy educated, so he sent him for an education to a fellow by the name of John Owen. John Owen was the greatest Puritan of his day. Now, if you know anything about the Puritans, you know, as Winston Churchill said, that they were the most biblical race of men that ever lived. Yes, even more biblical, much more biblical than ancient Israel ever thought of being. The Bible is a history, the Old Testament especially, of the unfaithfulness of God's people called Israel. The Puritans strove, and they're the ones that are our first founders, along with the Scots Presbyterians, but they had a strong sense of the laws of nature's God. That's the phrase that stands for the Bible. Well, John Locke was a fan of the Scottish Enlightenment. And that phrase and the idea is that there are two volumes of God's revelation of his will to men came out of the Scottish Enlightenment. Now, there are a lot of people that complain about the Scottish Enlightenment, and I understand why, but nonetheless, the Scottish Enlightenment had good things about it. And one of the good things it had about it, after the Reformation, after the laws of nature's God were clearly established as being the Bible, then people in Scotland came along and said, now, wait a minute, that's true. The Bible is the laws of God written in particular, and the final rule in cases of any disagreement or misunderstanding. But God has revealed himself through nature. And out of that, by the way, in Scotland came the explosion in all of Britain, and John Locke wasn't Scottish, he was English, but he was a fan of the Scottish Enlightenment, came the explosion of scientific discovery. A man named Boyle discovered things about fluids and pressure, Boyle's Law, we still talk about it today. A man named Faraday, he was a Scotsman, he discovered some of our most fundamental laws of electricity. He was a staunch Bible believer. He was so staunch in his belief of the laws of nature's God that he was considered to be radical even at that time. And then, of course, Sir Isaac Newton wasn't Scots, but he was English. He was the one that purportedly the apple fell on his head, and he came up with the idea that what goes up must come down, and the laws of gravity and the speed of falling objects, which is always constant, 32 feet per second per second. We learned that when I was a boy in school. Well, that came out of the Scottish Enlightenment and invaded all of Britain, invaded all of the English-speaking world. Even television was invented there. And the discovery of penicillin later saved Winston Churchill's life. By the way, Winston Churchill's father, this is just a quirk of history, Winston Churchill's father was a very promiscuous and dangerous man. He did a lot of good things. He was very giving, but he lived a lavish lifestyle that eventually killed him from venereal disease. But when he was in Parliament, he was up in Scotland one time, and he was got stuck in the mud in those days. The roads were really bad up there. They were forgottonia. Parliament didn't pay much attention to them. And a boy came along with a team of horses going to the field to work and offered to pull him out, pull his buggy out, which he did. The holes were so deep the horse couldn't even pull the buggy out of the hole. And Winston Churchill's father said to this boy, he said, well, what do you intend to do when you get over? He said, well, I want to go to medical school. He said, but I doubt if that'll ever happen. I don't have any money. He said, well, where do you want to go? He told him. He said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, you don't worry about it. You just go apply at this medical school you just told me about. I want you to go apply and see what happens. Of course, his idea was Winston Churchill's father would pay his tuition, which he did. And this boy went on then to discover penicillin. And penicillin came out right at the time that Winston Churchill was at that infamous meeting with Stalin and Roosevelt at that place over there by the Black Sea during World War II, and he was dying. He was dying. I think it was pneumonia. I don't remember exactly what it was, but at any rate, penicillin just became available because of what Winston Churchill's father did way back when. Unbeknownst to him, of course, he was gone by that time. But that saved Winston Churchill's life. Now, some people may say that was bad because we don't like Winston Churchill. Well, that may be. I'm not going to quarrel about that. That's a matter of fact and political opinion. But my point is this. Good deeds do come around to help our interests if we will but do them. But God does work in mysterious ways. Well, back to the Scottish Enlightenment. So there were two volumes by the time the Reformation and the Enlightenment came, two volumes in the English-speaking world, and by the time the our nation was founded politically, officially, in 1776, one more volume, set of volumes came along that reveals what was really going on in the minds of Americans, the rank-and-file Americans, and that was Encyclopedia Britannica. Encyclopedia Britannica was published in three volumes in 1776. It was the first edition. And it was published by a society of gentlemen, it says in the preface, a society of gentlemen from Scotland. And it was part of the Scottish Enlightenment. And what they wanted to do was write articles of knowledge about everything. And they ended up doing that. Of course, Encyclopedia Britannica was organized around the idea, that set of volumes, up through 1910, by the way. If you can find a set of Encyclopedia Britannica that is 1910 or before, and they're out there, don't hesitate to buy them, because Encyclopedia Britannica, written before, the volumes that came out 1910 and before, 1910 was the last edition that was put out under the policy that the laws of nature's God and the sovereignty of God and the unity of creation that enables all scientific investigation and prosperity comes under the heading of Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. He is Ahab, he is unified. That all came out of the Scottish Enlightenment. We still enjoy the offals of that today, and what we have in our country, the machinery of our government, our attitude and our understanding that is almost genetic in us, although I recognize it isn't, but there's something to be said for several hundred years of common law government. Those are the two volumes. Those are our fundamental law. If we would come back to those and say, this is God's revelation to us of right and wrong, it's final, and I have found, Dan, as that one famous historian said, as the prophet of the Old Testament did, when men come to a crisis, they instinctively turn their eyes toward their origins and look there for a sign. And I think God, I don't think it, I know it, God made us that way. So here we are looking back and saying, wait a minute, we're recognizing nothing good has ever happened in this world that men did not reach back and retrieve something that had been forgotten and reestablish it. That's what Magna Carta did. Magna Carta wasn't made out of whole cloth. That was Steve Langton's effort. He's the one that drafted it to reach back to the common law of the Anglo-Saxons. Our Constitution did the United States. Did the United States a favor the same way? Well, the fellows that drafted it. And Justice James Wilson on the first panel of our United States Supreme Court said, our common law in America, that's our laws of nature, as you had mentioned in the beginning, our common law, that's another name for it, is more like the laws of the Anglo-Saxons and the Anglo-Danes and the Celts that were in England before the Normans got there. It's our attempt to reach back, as did Magna Carta, reach back before the Norman invasion and reestablish the strength of property rights, because as Justice James Wilson said, property rights is the strength of our common law, and that was the strength of the Anglo-Saxon, the Dane, and the Celtic law, which were all essentially the same. They'd all migrated from the same area of Europe to Britain. We can go back and trace this reality. This is nothing new. What America did is nothing new. It is our attempt, and it's the way God made it, to reach back and say, wait a minute, we've lost something here. Let's reach back and reestablish it. They did it when our country was founded, and it's our duty to do it today. It can be done. It's been done before. Let's get at it and do it. But there is one thing I want to mention before I take a breather, because I think I need one, Dan. Maybe you've got some things you want to throw in. But our common law is sometimes called the laws of nature. And the laws of nature are not what most people believe it is. The evil empire has hijacked that term. It started in the Middle Ages. It started in the Middle Ages, and primarily with three men. One was Roman Catholic. One was a follower of Judaism, a Talmudic, Pharisaical kind of a fella. And the other was an Islamic sage by the name of Averroes. All three of those men were contemporaries, and all three of them did the same thing at the same time, and it overtook Europe, and it has become the popular view here. Of course, the Roman Catholic was a fellow called Thomas Aquinas, and his writings are the official doctrine of Rome. And Thomas Aquinas, through what he did, through what Averroes did, the Islamic sage from northern Africa, he's the one that introduced the idea that natural law is logic. It is governed, and logic is the focus of natural law. It is not. Logic is a tool. It's a good one, but logic is worthless. Worthless if it's not founded on something you know is proven fact. But once logic becomes the focus of education, facts have a way of receding from consideration. And it's important. And Merriman said that. He was a great comparative lawyer from Bolt Hall, Berkeley, and he's right. I see it. I see the evil empire, the left. They talk about how we must be logical, how we must be scholastic, how we must rest our understanding and be objective. Well, all that's true, but it's deceptive, because once you do that, fact recedes from consideration. It has a tendency to do that. How often I have seen and gone in, we were talking about this earlier, Dan, the facts of global warming, the facts that relate to our environment, the facts of so many things are the same. You can't change facts. But facts bounce off the useful idiots of the evil empire. I don't expect them to accept facts. I want to accept facts. I pray to my maker that he will give me the grace to accept facts. That's hard to do sometimes. I don't want to pull the shade on the window and say the sun's not shining when it is shining, to ignore reality and live in fantasy. The whole law of the city as opposed to the law of the land, natural law, our common law, all of that is about logic. It stresses logic. It is scholastic. As the chief rabbi of that day said, Mohammedes, that Judaism is a scholastic tradition. Romanism, that's the official doctrine, it's a scholastic tradition. Islam says Islam is a scholastic tradition. That's all law of the city. That's all Babylonian law. That's all the code of Justinian and fundamental principle. It's a matter of logic, perfectness, elegance, beauty. Well, our common law isn't that way. Our common law, our laws of nature, we're different than most every other country of the world. They're under the law of the city. They're under the code of Justinian in its various forms, the canon law, the Church of Rome, the German form, the code of Bismarck, the French form, the code Napoleon, covers the world. You say that's surely not from Europe, yes. Japan, under the code of the German form of the code. South Vietnam, of course, under the French form of the code. All of the communist states were under the code of Justinian. Why? Because the code of Justinian gives absolute power, if the government wants it, to do anything they want to do. Period. You know, it's no mystery, going back to the difference. Another grand difference. I knew a fellow once, knew him pretty well. You learned a lot from him. He was a prosecutor at Nuremberg when he was young. He's gone now. He was in his 30s then, so he died, I believe he passed away in 1991, long in there. But his name was William Franklin Fratcher, and he said the first question at Nuremberg was, what are we going to prosecute these Nazis under? Are we going to prosecute them under the law of France and Germany and Italy? And, in other words, the Code of Justinian, the Roman law, the law of the city? Or are we going to prosecute them under the law of the land, the common law of England, the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand? Or they're all the rest of the world? Well, they finally decided we've got to prosecute them under our common law, because if we don't, they'll all be acquitted. Why? Well, because in all those countries of the world, all the rest of the world, it's a complete defense to any crime that you obeyed the government. If you obeyed the government, you plead. If you're accused, you just plead, I obeyed the government, prove you obeyed the government, you're acquitted. All those men obeyed the government. Same thing was true with the Japanese when they were tried for war crimes. But listen to this. When our boys, Americans, were tried for war crimes after World War II, and our boys committed war crimes, yes, some of them did. General Marshall put out the general order to all courts martials of Americans being tried for war crimes, and he said that obedience to orders in such a case can be a mitigating factor, but it cannot be the exonerating fact. Let me break that down just a little further to say it without any adverbial modifying phrases. He was a general officer. General Officer Marshall put out the order that said the obedience to orders cannot be the exonerating fact in cases of war crimes. Well, that's the same standard that the Japanese and the Germans were tried under. And that is the standard that our military forces are still under, because we are a common law country, and even our martial law has that element in it. You cannot, as an American military man, say I obeyed orders, I can do anything I want. But I see that in our own country. That idea, it's a martial kind of law. The law of the city is scholastic. It's hard. It makes the trains run on time, but men don't have freedom is the problem. But martial law, admiralty law, has its place. Ships on the high seas for admiralty law. Armies in the fields of battle. Yes, that's a different law, and it's a different standard. It's a tough standard. It's hard to live under. By comparison, I took a test one time on martial law, Dan, and I remember the fellow I was studying with to try to pass the test. It was on the Uniform Code of Military Justice, because that's what we had to know. And everybody's supposed to know that's in the military. And we finally concluded if you do this, what's the punishment? And we finally said, wait a minute, if we just answer every question and say the punishment is death, or as a court martial may provide, we'll pass the test. And that's what we did. We passed the test, because of martial law, there is no equity. There is no mitigation of the crime. By and large, if you commit the crime, the punishment is severe. Well, at common law, that's not true. Our common law is a law. Our natural law, it is natural law, is the laws of nature. And the laws of nature's God, that's natural law. That came out of the Scottish Enlightenment. That's the phrase that's a part of our Declaration of 76 to talk about those two volumes. Well, Dan, I'm going to take a breather. And is there anything you want to throw in or direct the conversation in another direction?
As a matter of fact, then, one of the things I wanted to do, I want to keep us focused on a plan or a program here that people can really see how we're connecting the dots. And what I want to do is I want to define, and we're going into a break here shortly, so probably we'll have to pick this up on the other side of the break. But I want to define how our founding fathers used common law, natural law, to really create our legal framework for our whole system of government in a meaningful way. So let's take our break, and we'll get back on the other side.
Serving the planet, the micro effect. www.themicroeffect.com.
Well, welcome back to Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel. And today, my guest on the radio show is Brent Allen Winters. Before we get back into our discussion, I want to remind our listeners how important it is that you support this radio network. You support the programming that we do on this radio network, supporting Connecting the Dots and other programs that are on this network, because without your help, we can't continue to really spread this word around the world, because we are getting this message around the world, and we need to make sure that we continue with that message. We are spreading the truth, and we are one of the few outlets that really do that in a meaningful way. So please support this network and support our programming. Okay, Brent, when we get into the discussion here, I don't want to get too far afield because there's so many things we want to talk about that are so important. You and I had a great discussion yesterday about the role of private property. Our founding fathers were visionary. They understood. They were very religious men. They understood natural law. They understood what the common law was created from natural law. They were philosophically very sophisticated. They were classical liberals in the sense that they had a really solid classical education, most of them. And they really understood very simple ideas, and yet at the same time they could weave those into one of the most sophisticated systems of government in the entire world, because it allowed for the rights of man and private property and all the things that we hold so dear in this country, and do it in a way that really had never been done before, not in a meaningful way. Even though the English have their common law, they really didn't have the same sense of private property that the United States of America has developed. And it's really important that we bring that concept forward. So let's talk about, first of all, how natural law supports the ideas of private property. And then I'd like you to really get into a discussion about what is Justinian law, so that our listeners can really understand its roots, its foundation, and why so much of the world is using that, because communism thrives under Justinian law. So go ahead. Let's talk about, first of all, private property and common law or natural law, and how that relationship is so strong in the United States because of our founder's vision of the importance of private property.
Well, the clearest statement in support of private property on the books is out of that greatest of all law books, said Justice Peacham, called the Bible. And it's found in that set of first principles. You can find them in the second writing of the Bible, called the Book of Exodus, chapter 5 and chapter 20, repeated in chapter 20. And it says this, in the English translation there, it says, "Thou shalt not steal." Thou shalt not steal. That's a statement in favor of private property. You can't steal something that doesn't belong to another fellow. He has to have title to it. It's his. He who takes what isn't his'n, I learned as a boy, he who takes what isn't his'n shall pay the price or wind up in prison, trying to impress upon us the importance of private property. But as Tom Jefferson put it, it's important to recognize, and they recognize this, those fellows back there that were trying to break the bands of Britain off of the colonies here, Jefferson recognized that property is tangible and it's intangible. What does that mean? That means, well, you got property, you can touch it and feel it with your fingers. You got property you can't touch and feel with your fingers. That's tangible and intangible. We have, as Jefferson put it, we have rights and property, and we have property and rights. We have both. Those are two words that bespeak the same thing, like ice and snow. Snow is water. It's H2O. Somebody sent me a video the other day, Dan, about people who couldn't tell the difference. It was a joke, but it was funny to watch people putting on bathing suits and diving off the tops of their trucks into snowbanks and then trying to swim. Well, it doesn't work very well because it is water, but it's a different form. Well, that's the way it is with tangible and intangible property. It's the flip side of the same coin, but in different forms, so we deal with it a little differently. If you have a piece of land at common law, again, our common law is another word for the laws of nature, the way things are in the nature of things, and they're not going to change. Law is something, it's what doesn't change. And property is tangible or intangible. If somebody says, well, I just bought 40 acres around here, they'd say, I bought 40 acres. Somebody would say, well, did you get the gas rights? Well, yeah, I got the gas. Did you get the oil rights? Yeah, I got the oil rights. Did you get the surface rights? Yeah. How about the gravel rights? Yeah, I got. How about the water rights? You get that? Yeah, I got that too. Did you get the timber rights? Yeah, got that. Because in our common law country, we have, as you've used the word, sophistication. And this is ancient with us. It's not something that the people that started this country invented. It is our common law. We can divide the rights and property on a piece of land up as many ways as we want in America, as creative as we want to be in doing it. Because land, as your toothbrush or any other piece of property, it has, as we say at common law, it's really when you buy it, you're getting a bundle of intangible rights, things you can't see, but you can do. The tangible property is the toothbrush or the car or the land, but with that, then you have tangible rights. That's not true in the rest of the world. And when I say the rest of the world, I mean covering like a blanket the entire faces of the earth. Under the code of Justinian, almost every country, that's not true. Why? Well, the government governs all that. And, of course, one of the things we can notice, for instance, with that is, does land belong primarily to the government or does it belong to people? Do minerals belong in the first instance to the discoverer of them? Does wildlife belong in the first instance to the capturer of them, such as oil? We say oil is captured. It's not like hard rock minerals. You got to find it where it's flowing. Water, same way, but at common law, we can separate those out and sell them as separate rights or trade them or buy them as separate rights. I know people, I just talked to a lady the other day, they've been paying for the oil rights on a piece of land here around home for four generations. And $10 a year, the taxes on those oil rights, they're filed in the real estate section down in that safe room in the center of the courthouse, just like all other rights and property. But to make one other distinction, you talked about, and that's the importance of property rights in our common law tradition are ancient. It is true that we tried to reach back beyond the Norman conquest. When the Normans arrived and conquered England in the year 1066, they brought with them the imprint of the Code of Justinian. They'd been on the coast of France. They were from Norway. They were Norwegians. They'd been on the coast of France for about 165 years, and they had been heavily Romanized from that experience, because that was part of the old Roman Empire, the Holy Roman Empire by that time. When they got to England, they immediately took Roman priests and replaced all the common law judges in the courts with Roman priests. Well, what's a Roman priest? He's a lawyer, a very highly trained lawyer of the Code of Justinian, the canon civil law of the Church of Rome. Well, then William announced at that time that the common law would remain the law of England. That was the way of the Normans wherever they conquered. They conquered Sicily. They did the same thing. Whatever law they had, they said it's in place. But there was a twist to it. What they wanted to add was administrative precision. That's part of the law of the city. And the bureaucratic law became part of England at that point in a way it never had been before. That was from the Papal Revolution, as Harold Berryman from Harvard used to talk about, wrote a book on the subject. bureaucratic law rose out of Rome. Bureaucratic law, administrative law, reached a pinnacle during the French Revolution in France. All that came before the French Revolution to England. So by the time that was in 1066, by the time Magna Carta came around, the Englishmen were screaming bloody murder to high heaven. You've got to back off. There's too much Code of Justinian getting stuck in our common law. We're not enjoying the right to trial by jury and the purity we did before, or the Anglo-Saxons did. And so Magna Carta was written for that reason, to try to reach back and reestablish what existed before. When our country started, we saw the same thing. But we did not. The folks that were at the beginning of our country didn't invent anything. The truth is, we didn't really have a revolution here at all. We didn't change anything, not really. Our courts existed and continued. Our legislatures existed and continued, just had as they had to a great degree before the war. That's why our break from Britain was so successful compared to a South American revolution. You know, they don't call them revolutions for nothing. Revolution has to do with things that revolve. That's why they call them revolutions. That's politics. They revolve. This set of thugs gets in power. They abuse everyone else, their opponents, and then they lose favor because of the way they've acted, and then the other set of thugs gets in power. That's political reality in South America, because they're all under the code of Justinian. It's just constant revolution, round and round and round and round. Our founders did not do that. They said, wait a minute, we're not only going to continue things the way they were, we're just going to make them even stronger than they were before. We're going to, as one historian said, it's true, Dan, the Americans are more English than the English, because the English have departed from our common law. I want to say a couple of things, because while they're on my mind, I don't want to forget them, and you had mentioned this, and this goes along with what you'd asked me to talk about. What are the principles that have allowed us as a common law country to do so well? Well, common law, there is what we call the common law of government, how government functions. And we didn't change that much. Now, we did a little, but not much. We made it stronger. But one of the chief features of common law government is separation of powers. In the communist countries, they're under the code of Justinian, or the South America countries like Argentina, they're comfortable. Mexico, they're comfortable with no separation of powers. You just have one man in charge, and that one man controls everything, the courts, the legislature, and he appoints judges, and if the judges doesn't do what he wants, he just fires them. Well, we have provisions in our Constitution. Our Constitution of the United States is a brief of common law government. Once a fellow grasps that idea, then it becomes more understandable. Everything about our Constitution is about common law government. As Justice Taft, Chief Justice Taft of our Supreme Court said, it is a brief of common law government. The people that drafted it were awash in the phrases and words of our common law. And you cannot understand our Constitution of the United States unless you understand that it is informed at every point by our common law, because our Constitution doesn't define anything. It just throws out words. It throws out the word dollar, for example. It throws out the words trial by jury. It doesn't explain them at all. Why? Because the people that signed on to that understood those concepts. It was part of who they were. They served on the jury. The King of England said, I'm not king in England, therefore I'm common law king in England. I'm emperor in the American colonies. Just to drop a footnote, Dan, that's why slavery was permitted in the colonies, and slavery has never, ever, ever been lawful on the island of the country of England. It has existed there, but no law ever permitted it. And Justice Mansfield made that point in the Somerset case about a slave that came from Virginia and filed a writ of, he absconded and filed a writ of habeas, somebody filed a writ of habeas corpus for him. He was with his master. And they ruled that he was free because his foot set in a slaveless jurisdiction, England, under the common law. Well, they said the colonies have slavery, therefore that's okay. Even Blackstone, Dan, in his first volume of his commentaries we talked about a while ago, he said that our common law does not apply in our American plantations. That's why we went to war, by the way, because the people who were here said, no, our common law does apply. Natural law, to use that word, that phrase, the Declaration. Go ahead, Dan, I'll take a breather. Something you want to say?
Yeah, good. Well, this is a good discussion, Brett. One of the things, and you alluded to this when you were talking about private property or property rights, but people don't realize that literally everything of our essence, of our being, is private property. Our thoughts, our body, our conversations, our philosophy, all that is our private property. And we have deviated so far from that. And the reason that the people on the left, the people that want to take away our rights and enforce us under Justinian law, the reason they're doing that is because they recognize that without private property, we have absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. We can't think, we can't speak, we can't do anything, as well as physical property. So I think it's important that you tell our listener just how fundamental property rights really are when you're talking about freedom of speech and all the other things that are part of our American experience.
Well, I appreciate you nudging me in that direction. Let me come at it from this angle. This might be revealing. It is to me. There are only three things that any man can have in this life, only three things. And our founding documents put those three things together. And they stand and fall together. Life, liberty, and property. There is nothing else that any man ever receives from above. And that's where we get everything from above. Everything mankind has known through centuries in the history of on all the continents. They've come to the conclusion that everything we have comes from above. Even the pagans conclude this in their pagan way. It comes from above. It comes to the Lamb. And therefore we retrieve it from there. That's where the wealth arises. And even our law, it's always been recognized, arises from the Lamb. That's why our common law, anciently, has been called the law of the Lamb. That phrase appears in our Constitution of the United States, Article 6. It was lifted from Magna Carta. Stephen Langton put it there. Stephen Langton, by the way, I like to drop footnotes. Stephen Langton was the man, he drafted Magna Carta, he was the man that gave us our chapter divisions to our Bible. He was a biblicist, again, history, of course, methodically tries to hide that. It is too much for people, but it's true. He was the foremost Old Testament commentator of his day, Stephen Langton. But he put that phrase in there because at that time he wrote it in Latin, by the way, so that the Roman priesthood could read it easily all over Europe, no matter what language they spoke. They all spoke and read Latin. He wrote it in Latin, and the phrase in Latin is lex terra. Lex terra. Lex is law, and terra, like territory, it means dirt, ground. It is the law of the land, or you could translate it, the land law. And the law of the land is the foundation of all property law because all property arises from the land. You can't have a toothbrush. You can't have a piece of paper. You can't have a pencil. You can't have an automobile that is either worried from the mountains in hard metals and mineral, or it is worried or coaxed, I should say, from the soil and crops. I grew up in a place then where the largest processor of soybeans and corn in the world existed. Well, there's a lot of soybeans and corn around there. It was A.E. Staley. A.E. Staley's. And eventually, A.E. Staley really went like gangbusters. Then ADM, which was nearby, took over. A.E. Staley was purchased by a British outfit, and they aren't as powerful as they were. But A.E. Staley really went like gangbusters when it was discovered that soybeans could be used as a part of making plastic, and when the plastic revolution came in the 50s and 60s, of course, the demand for soybeans then became very economical. Before that, it was just used for hay, pretty much. It wasn't that economical. But every time I look at a piece of plastic, I think to myself, well, that came out of the ground. Every time I look at an automobile, I think, well, that came out of the ground. Steel and aluminum, and it comes out of the ground. The plastic, and there's nothing that doesn't come from the ground. I need to belabor the point, but we ought to remember that. But when we get removed as a people from being close to the ground, down to the ground, connected to the ground in a direct and meaningful, visual, tangible way, we do, we're this weak and fickle, we lose sight of that. And once we lose sight of that, we lose sight of where law comes from. It comes from property, as you had mentioned. And property law, and land law, even more fundamentally, is the basis of all freedom. I mentioned a while ago, life, liberty, property. Life, liberty, and property. These three stand and fall together, like Father, Son, Holy Ghost, we'd say. It's true there too. You can't, body, soul, and spirit. The Creator and the laws of nature has made things in trilogy. Body, soul, and spirit. I have a body, I have a soul, I have a spirit. The spirit is intangible, the soul is not. The soul I can't see, but I can feel it. What is it? It's oxygen and air. It's the exchange, the respiratory. It's almost a miracle. We don't understand everything about it. Hemoglobin is the most complex compound known to man. That's what enables respiration. That's the soul. Soul. The Bible speaks of these. Our law speaks of these, therefore, our common law. The body, soul, and spirit. You take the soul out, the body drops dead. They stand and fall together, the three. You can separate them and discuss them separately, but they're inextricably bound, and if you pull them apart, all three fall. Same is true with life, liberty, and property. You send a man to prison, most people don't know what that's like, and I hope you never do, but you do learn things in places like that. If you're in prison, you discover that you don't have freedom of locomotion anymore. You can't go where you want to go. You can't choose what you want to eat. You can't choose what socks to put on in the morning. That's no longer true for the prisoner. Therefore, he has lost his jurisdiction, his scope of authority to make discerning decisions about himself. In other words, that's his property, as you pointed out. It's intangible. Jurisdiction is property. What is jurisdiction? It is the authority, the scope of authority that your maker has put direct on you without any intermediary, any mediator, any middleman. We call those, by the way, at common law, called fundamental rights. We have not an exhaustive list, but a list of some of those in our Constitution of the United States, fundamental rights, such as, in our day and age, expressed this way, the right to keep and bear arms. That's a fundamental right. Where does it come from? Direct from your maker. Direct, that's important. If there's a mediator in between, that's not a fundamental right. Our law would call that a civil right. That's by permission of government. The right to speak, the right to associate with whom you wish to associate. That, by the way, that freedom of association includes the right to the God, as you understand, and you associate with, your lawgiver. The right to associate with other men in government. The right to associate in contract. The right to associate in trust relationships, the right to associate in covenant of marriage and children, all of those. By the way, just to drop another footnote, the word right has been hackneyed. It has become to denote something selfish. It's not. The old Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-Dane word right, which became famous, it's a related word in World War II, the Third Reich, that's a related word, a little different. But there is a fundamental meaning of that word right. It's a Germanic word, R-I-G-H-T. And what it means most fundamentally is duty, responsibility. I always heard when I was a kid growing up, every right is accompanied by a corresponding duty, and every duty is accompanied by a corresponding right. Well, that's not really true. That's weak. That's not it. That's not what that word means. That's not what that word ever meant. That word means duty. In other words, if you have, as we say, our Constitution says, the right to keep and bear arms, that's a property right. It's intangible, but it is a right and property. As Jefferson said, we have rights and property in our rights. Well, the right to keep and bear arms, even more fundamentally, to understand it a right, there's that word again, it is a duty. As Granville Sharp said, the Brit, who lived about the time of our separation from Britain, he did an exhaustive study on the right to keep and bear arms, and he said this. He said, history shows that at common law, it is the duty of every Englishman to be armed. And further than that, he said, not only armed, but it is his duty to be expert at arms. That's the foundation, understand, of our common law right, as our Second Amendment expresses it. But to not understand that the common law informs the Second Amendment, is to really not understand the Second Amendment and say funny things. Let me give you another example of our Constitution. How are those folks that put it together, they were just putting together the common law and trying to, of course, strengthen our common law. People say, for example, the right to trial by jury. We have that right. Well, yeah, but what is that? There are countries all over the world following our lead say, we have the right to trial by jury. I just read recently that South Korea South Korea under the Justinian Code, they have instituted the right to trial by jury. But then when I looked into it, I found out that it looks like the right to trial by jury. It smells like the right to trial by jury. It feels like the right to trial by jury, but it isn't. You know why? Because there is a court put in place that does nothing but review everything the jury says and overturns it if they want to. Well, that's not the right to trial by jury. Among men, the lawgiver among men, as the Bible says, is the jury. God, with a little g, the lawgiver, from whose decision there is no meaningful appeal. And that's why our Constitution even says that. That's a common law doctrine. It says that the decision of the jury about the facts of the case are not to be reviewed anywhere, except, of course, according to the common law. One more thing, and I'm going to take a breather, because I got to. But I want to mention this, Dan. Our common law is not a list of laws. It is a way of life. It is a way, W-A-Y. It is a process. Our Constitution of the United States calls it due process. I'd mentioned a while ago the law of the land, Magna Carta, Lex Terra, lifted from there, put in our Constitution, law of the land. That is not about a list of laws. That is a phrase, anciently, in our common law tradition. It used to be called the Volk right in the old Anglo tongue, the Volk, like Volkswagen. That means the people, the folk, F-O-L-K, we say it with an F. The people's duty, the Volk right. The people's responsibility. What is the people's responsibility? Governing. That's the people's responsibility. There are two duties to governing. Our oath that men take when they take an oath of office, our Constitution requires it. It's a common law oath to support the law of the land. What's the law of the land? Well, our Constitution says it's the law of the land. It's not what is to be done. It does not stress what is to be done. It stresses how, H-O-W, it is to be done. This is consistent with the laws of nature. The laws of nature is God, written in the Bible. That's why Jesus Christ said, for example, he didn't say, I'm the law. I'm the list of laws. He said, I'm the way you're to do things. The Old Testament talks about the way, the paths of the law. Justice Holmes of the Supreme Court wrote a piece that became very famous a long time ago called The Paths of the Law. Why? Because our common law is a course of process. We, in our common law tradition, traditionally, we do not say we must reach the result of the statute that the government commands, or the government commands through the statute. That's what they say in the rest of the world. Whatever we do in our tribunals, we must reach the result the government commands. We don't say that here. We're saying it more and more in our bureaucratic state, but we shouldn't be. In a common law, we say we're going to focus not on the result we've got to reach, but the process we've got to follow. Because if we follow the process that the law tells us to follow, called due process, then the result will take care of itself. Let the chips fall where they may. That's not our business. And that's why the Bible says, of course, do not be afraid of the face of any man as a juror or as a judge. Don't be afraid of them. Why? Because if you follow due process, the judgment is not yours. It's mine. You follow due process. You cookbook due process. The result that I want...
We're going to give you your break here. Okay. We're moving into our top-of-the-hour commercial break. We'll be back on the other side, and we can pick this conversation up.
Thank you, Dan.
Serving the planet, the micro-effect.
www.themicroeffect.com.
You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
A mighty nation, blessed above all of creation. It was a rare and precious pearl, conceived in faith and liberty, home of the brave, land of the free. It was the envy of the world. But this shining city on a hill has turned from the Creator's will and let evil take control. Now the reckless men who lead them want to strip away their freedom and to steal their very soul. Now it's smoke and mirrors, switch and bait, criticize and confiscate, and let the guilty walk away. In this once righteous godly nation, in the halls of education, they forbid the child to pray. They say we need to spread the wealth. They pretend to guard the health of the feeble and the poor. While the hand they hold behind their back confuses and conceals the fact that the wolf is at the door.
Well, welcome back to Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel. And today, our guest on the radio program is Brent Allen Winters. And Brent, you're talking about some important concepts, and I'm going to throw some things in here that I'd like to head in this direction. And you mentioned our Declaration of Independence, or as you call it, Declaration of 1776, and our Constitution. Before that, we actually had our I'm trying to think of the founding document that actually came before our Constitution, the Articles of Confederation. And all these things were based on biblical, God-given principles of natural law. And, you know, we hear from the left that, our Constitution is an outdated, outmoded thing, and it's too simple, it's too, it's geared for a whole different time, and on and on and on. And the reality is, the reason that that document is so simple, as you say, is that it's intuitive. It's brilliantly written, because it actually outlines ideas and principles that are so fundamental and so basic. If you believe in natural law and you are a Christian person, and that's the part that they're trying to destroy, because under Justinian law, there's literally nothing that they can't manipulate to create an outcome that they want. And with Justinian law, the lawyers write it. And one of the reasons that they like that kind of law, and it's also one of the reasons they're fighting so hard to get an Article 5 convention, is that they can literally destroy the foundation of our Constitution. They can destroy the foundation of our common law, because then they'd make a transition into Justinian law. And we've not really defined exactly what Justinian law, and I'm talking historically. Would you talk about a little bit about the foundations of Justinian law and why it's so important that we return to our common law heritage and get away from the Justinian law?
Well, yeah, that's great direction to go. I'm glad you bring me back to fundamentals, and that's what I like to talk about. But the subject then swells, and I sometimes get off of directly that. But here's the fundamental of it. There are only two traditions of religion, law, and government in the world. There have never been more than two, and there never will be any more than two. I don't care what it looks like. I don't care how different it is. There are only two. There is the truth, the true lawgiver. True lawgiver has set his will. The will of the sovereign is law. The true lawgiver, his will is law. And then there's everything else. And everything else is fundamentally the same. But amazingly, everything else falls under, in most cases, even that hard code of the Justinian, that hard code of the law of the Roman Empire. So from whence did it come? Well, of course, it arose first in sophisticated fashion at the settling of the city called Babylon about over 4,200 years ago. And we can go back even and read the laws of that city and the mercantile law of that city, and we can see clearly. But it's the code of Justinian. What does that mean? Well, back at Babylon, there was a man named Nimrod. The Bible gives us a clear record of this, of the personalities involved. And tradition of history gives us a lot more, even. And it's incontrovertible, again. It's pretty reliable evidence of history. But Nimrod, the fundamental of the law of the city is it is government by a single will. Government by a single will. And that means also government by the single will of, for example, a combination of men, such as a legislature. They combine their will into one. They're all their wills combined into one, and they pass legislation. And they say, this is what, I know that all of them don't agree, but the way it works, that's what it comes out to, the combined will into one, and that becomes law, period. No exceptions. There is no appeal from that. It's meaningful. That was, of course, a national socialism, such as Nazism, sometimes called fascism in Italy, communism, a law of a single will. In that case, they called it the party boss. Among Islamic people, it's traditionally been called a satrap, or they have different names for the man who rules like a dictator, kills who he wants, does what he wants, may appear benevolent and loving at times, he can get away with it, but it's a single will. And it can be expressed in many ways, and that single will then controls all powers of government, the legislature and the judicial. The difference there, this is one of the fundamental differences, there are many ways we can express it. I like this one, it's a good one. We talked about one is process-oriented, all the rest of the world is result-oriented. Here's another one just to throw in. In all the rest of the world, you die for the leader, you die for the government if you go to war. In our tradition of religion, law, and government, our leader dies for us. Jesus Christ died for us, for our sake. We don't die for him. The Japanese, my father was in the islands during the war. He tells me about the kamikaze planes. Those boys committed to dying for their God. And they did. 100,000 Japanese jumped off the cliffs at Iwo Jima at the order of their God. They died for him. He lived through the war, and President Reagan even went to his funeral. I'm saying that to point out that he lived a long time. He didn't die for them. No. They died for him. You die for the government. The state, as Hegel said, this is the foundation of it too. Hegel said the state is God walking on earth. So we die for him. And those that would say we stand in the place of God, the priesthoods of the world, oh, we're not God, but we stand in the place of God. You must obey us. That's the very definition of Antichrist. There are many Antichrists. It comes down to government and religion, whether people want to acknowledge it or not, it's still true. It's the deepest convictions we have are of government, period. All of us. And that comes down to the response to our lawgiver, whether it be true or false. But there are only two traditions of religion, law, and government. A government by single will, and a government as according to our common law, which are the laws from nature's God, how he has set it up among us. He undergirds that with the Bible, the laws of nature, the laws of nature of God written in the Bible, mutually supportive with the laws of nature and vice versa. In cases of disagreement or misunderstanding, as the Reformers said, the laws of nature's God written in the Bible are the final rule, not the Code of Justinian. What's the final rule in the world of the Code of Justinian? It is the Code of Justinian, whether it be the canon law, not the Bible, the canon law. All the universities of the world were established for that very purpose, to establish the Code of Justinian to supplant the Bible as the final rule of faith and practice. Now, that's a matter of history. That's a fact. And it's not something we can change. And our common law is about finding fact and following a course of process. It's not about logic. Facts being so stubborn as they are. We start with that. Men will think it through if they want to. If they don't, there's nothing you can do to help them. They'll subvert the fact. But our tradition of religion, law, and government is a common law tradition. People say, well, why do you say that's Christian? Is that Christian? Is that a religion? And the answer is yes. It always has been. And just the story of our own Supreme Court, served longer than anybody else in the Supreme Court, wrote the commentaries he did. After 40 years, 39 years of shakedown experience with our Constitution, he wrote the commentaries on the Constitution. He said there never has been a time, never has been a time in our common law tradition that Christianity did not lie at its very foundation. He said our bankruptcy laws are part of our Christian tradition from the Bible, the year of Jubilee. And it would be a travesty among us if we did not have a process whereby men could escape a debt that they could never get rid of. Just as one example. All of these things,
Brent,
are common law tradition.
I'm going to break in here a second. We've got a caller online that wants to ask you a question, and then we'll get back into the discussion. I do want to talk about how important it is to keep our Constitution and to guard against an Article 5 convention. because I think you and I both understand that the technocrats, the bureaucrats, would love more than to destroy what our founders created. So anyway, with that, we've got a caller on the line. Would you like to ask Brent a question?
Yes, it's Jim from Illinois. Good morning, guys. Hello.
Morning, Tim. Hey, good to talk to you.
Good to listen to you guys and talk with you. Anyway, Brent, when you say everything is from the land, that would basically be the earth as stated within the Declaration. Jefferson had laid this out, memorialized this in the Declaration. And it was to assume among the powers of the earth the equal and separate stations to which laws of nature and of nature's God entitled them. And that is a very inclusive statement there. And also it states the first principles which come from the Creator. And the Creator, according to Genesis 1, 26 through 28, never gave dominion of man over another man. So, you know, it would seem that they, when they assumed this position, they never really acquiesced or waived. It always was laying, it was always there to be picked up or retained by man. And a lot of times I think that that is left out, the powers of the earth is left out of the equation when we state the natural law and the law of God. All three of them must be maintained in equal order. And so I'm just asking you know, of course that's my conjecture, and I'm just asking you, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, repeat again for me, please. What are the three things that you say must be in balance?
The powers of the earth, the equal and separate stations to which laws of nature and of nature's God entitled.
Oh, okay. No. Yes, that's important, obviously. Now, I want to hasten that real quick. I'll say it categorically. The Declaration of 76, the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, the Constitution of the United States, these are not the final word on anything. These are men's observations upon which we agree, and I think they're good ones. And I don't find very much about them that is objectionable, by the way. A few things. I think I could have said, I shouldn't be so arrogant as to say that. I think somebody could have said it a little better in a couple places.
But, well, the thing is this is what I take away from that is, at that time, the people, as they were living, they had a better understanding because they were closer to the earth. They were closer to the gospel. Most people call it the Bible. And, you know, the gospel I really have to state this, that people, you know, when you fail to read that tome, you really put yourself at a disadvantage, okay? And with that, I think I'd say thanks a lot for taking my call, and you guys have a great day.
Well, appreciate it. The separate powers of the earth, I would take it to mean the separate peoples and tongues and tribes of the earth. And it's clear, the Bible tells us, in no uncertain terms, that God himself, the maker of heaven and earth, has divided men among the earth, and he has allocated separate parcels of real estate to them. This is the theme of the whole Bible. It starts in the garden we call Eden, the garden of delight, as the Hebrew word would put it. And there, of course, our grandpa Adam and our grandma Eve were placed, and he gave them a parcel of real estate, and he said, I want you to take care of it. It's property that has been bequeathed to you by trust settlement. Take care of it. Guard it. Do not let it be polluted. But our grandpa, instead of doing what his maker told him, he ended up following the will of his wife, Eve. And the Bible tells us in the New Testament that she did what she did in ignorance. He didn't. And that was the problem. she really didn't understand what she was doing, but he was foolish enough to go along with it. And that's where we really fell down. There was an order breakdown there of God and government. That's where it began. But all of it had to do with land. So by the time we get, of course, Adam and Eve were thrown out off the parcel of real estate because they had allowed it to be polluted. And then God, of course, promised the land to Abraham, land, the parcel of real estate, called the land of Canaan. And it's questionable right now in our own day what that's all about, whether or not there's a connection between those people that are there and those people that descended from Abraham. Abraham, we like to hasten to add, was not an Israelite. He was an Assyrian. And the promise was to him, and it was to his people, his descendant, through Jacob and Isaac. Yes, I understand that. And I don't want to get off on that discussion, but I do want to point out in general that that is a prototype of what God has said he will do for all of Adam's race. He will give to us a land. He has given to us a land. And he says to us, just as he said to them, if you don't pollute this land, if you guard it, if you deal with it according to the terms that I give you. And when you read the Bible, you see that God wants us to take care of his land. He's so concerned about land that he only applies the Sabbath principle to himself, to the crowning of his creation, mankind, and then he applies it to the land. The land is precious to him. The reason we are here is to care for the land, period, and to reap from it what God wants us to reap from it, the blessings that it brings to us. And there's not a man on the face of the planet, not a man that can live without land. Even those, and I've seen them in the Far East, by the hundreds, tens of thousands at least, piled up in houseboats along the shore. They're not out on the sea. They're next to the land. Even they depend upon the land. God made us that way. And in the end, when we get to the end of the laws of nature of God, written in the Bible, we discover that there will be no more seas. There will be only land, and there will be no more cities. No more cities. Well, if there's no more cities, there's no need for the law of the city, or no excuse for it, I should say. And if there's no more seas, there's no need for another form of the law of the city, the martial kind of law called admiralty law. And in the end, it'll be the land, it'll be man taking care of it, and it'll be the maker of land and of heaven. But right now, things are divided. And the Bible tells us about these times when things are divided among the tribes, the tongues, and the people of the earth. And God has done that. He's the one that's behind it. He is the one that has given us this land, and he wants us to take care of it. And it is our duty. Nothing makes me sicker. And as I get older, I get sicker, Dan. And the fellow that just called in, he probably sees it being in, back in that part of the world, farmers that won't leave a strip of sod along the road ditch and want to farm every gully. And the gullies grow and the topsoil washes away in mass. But that's not taking care of the land. That's being selfish and being blind to your resource. That's important topsoil. Once it's gone, it doesn't come back, but it's going to take a few more 100,000 years or however long it's supposed to take. I don't know how it got there, glaciers, but I know once it's gone, we don't have the power to get it back. And we need to take care of this land. That's what it's all about, well, and I assume that's what you're bringing up. Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, Brent, I understand that whole concept that really property is based on utilization, and it's based on, a very hard asset, but don't we also recognize that common ownership, like they're trying to sell us on with various programs like UN Agenda 21 and all these other things that create common ownership and take away private property rights, if you want to see the worst stewardship in the world, go ahead and look at the communist countries where the government controls the land or the use of the land and allocates how it's going to be used.
Oh, no question. As they say, what belongs to everybody belongs to nobody, and nobody will take care of it. And that's what you got with government-owned land. And every lawyer who knows anything about the subject knows. Every lawyer who knows anything about the subject knows that the worst trustee in the world, the most irresponsible and dangerous trustee in the world, is the government. I advise people, don't put your land under some kind of a land trust with the state government or the federal government. They'll ruin it. Back where I'm from, we have, back in that neck of the woods, called the Shawnee National Forest. And when the Shawnee National Forest went in, almost entire counties depopulated. This was during the socialistic Roosevelt administration. And in order to justify it, they told the people there that they took off of these beautiful farms in that part of the world. They said, well, we're going to plant trees in here that are going to be good timber in 20, 30 years, and you're going to see profits like you never saw before, and we're going to help you participate in that. Well, I tell you for a fact right now that those trees that were planted there were not native to the area. They have been let go. The Shawnee National Forest, instead of being well cared for and productive and beautiful, is now a tangled mess of trees that don't even belong there. And they go so far now, they won't even let people walk, much less ride their mules or horses into that national forest. Why? Because government is not about land. Let me add this. A difference between the Code of Justinian, the law of the city in general, and the law of the land is this. One of the grand differences. And this follows, of course, the laws of nature of God written in the Bible. The law of Justinian is about getting money out of men, dominating men, taking from other men. That's the way you get rich in that system. The law of the land is about dominating the land, being involved in a business, a calling that encourages production of land. It's about dominating land, not about dominating men. And it is no accident, of course, that Jesus Christ himself said in the gospel records, he said, do not be as the nations who seek to dominate one another. Well, what's he talking about? He's talking about that trust settlement way back there with Adam when he told our grandpa Adam, take lordship over this parcel of real estate and dominate it. He did not say, take lordship over your fellow man and dominate him. That's why Christianity is about domination of land and what comes out of it, and not domination of men. And the Code of Justinian is just the opposite. It's all about domination of men. And people that live in a system like that and have for generations, they accept it. I talked to a person right at my age. We were talking about what it was like to grow up in the days of the Cold War. This person was from Russia. And we laughed. I laughed. This person was telling me, well, we weren't allowed to own an Elvis record or a rock and roll record, and the government did this and the government did that. And I said, listen, let me ask you a question. In your country of Russia, how do you know who has the right to rule? Oh, I said, that's easy. The person that has the power and is willing and shows he's willing to use it, he has the right to govern. Wow. Which is the opposite of our common law tradition. Might does not make right in our minds. It does in theirs, and he accepts that. After generations and thousands of years, he accepts that. But in our country, we would say, well, no. Right makes might. Authority comes before use of power. You've got to have jurisdiction before you have the right to act. And if you act without the authority to do so, you're a criminal. Well, they don't see it that way in the rest of the world. And the proof of authority is not the possession of power, but the possession and use of power. Then that's the proof. We will bow down and let you rule. Well, that's the way it is, for example, in the country called Russia. Dan, back to you if you had a comment. I don't want to overrun things.
No, actually, we're moving into a break, but we'll pick this up on the other side because it's important that our listeners really understand the foundation of our Constitution and our system of government.
Serving the planet, the micro effect.
www.themicroeffect.com.
Connecting the Dots with Dan Happel, and today our guest on the radio show is Brent Allen Winters, and we are doing a really thorough discussion about just exactly what is natural and common law and why it is so important for our country and for the people who live here. And Brent, before we get back into the discussion, we're here to connect dots, and what I want to do is I want to connect the dots between why it is so important for those on the other side, those who want communism, those who want a controlled society, those who think man is, you know, the ultimate authority, and yet at the same time they want to control man, why is it so important for them to separate us from common law, natural law, and the fact that those laws are based on nature's law, on God's law, and they're based in very, very strong Christian concepts. And when these people try to move us away from that and, you know, want to do things like Article 5 conventions and things that will destroy our connection with natural law, our connection with biblical law, when they do that, they will be ultimately able to destroy our biblical connection, period, because our law, our system of government, the way the founders envisioned it, was based on Christian concepts very strongly. And the people on the left are the ones that are trying to say, no, 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 it was never, these men weren't Christian men, or at least a lot of them weren't. It was based on something totally different than natural law or God's law. It was based on an egalitarian system that really put government in charge. And I just want to make sure we direct this back to the idea how important it is for those of us who ban that to protect what we have and to throw off those on the left that want to destroy our connection with God.
Well, to go back to an experience I had not too many years ago, I was privileged to interview at that time the most well-known state Supreme Court judge in the country, probably. Nice fella in his own way. And I was asking some simple questions. And I interviewed also another well-known lawyer in conservative circles. If I said his name, you'd probably all know it, or many would. But I'm not going to mention their names because I don't have anything personally against them. But I asked both of them the same question. And I thought that they would quickly answer and clear things up. Silly me, it wasn't true. I asked one of them, who has final say on right and wrong and among the branches of government. And he said, well, you know the answer to that. And I said, well, even if I knew, people don't care what I know. I'm just interviewing you. They really want to know. You're famous. They want to know what you think. And he said, well, you know it's the Supreme Court of the United States. Well, that was not true. It's not true. It's never been true. I didn't know what to say after he said that. The branches of government are co-equal. The Supreme Court is not the trumping branch of the other two branches. They live in a constant, never-ending, perpetual Mexican standoff. That's the way Madison and the rest of them wanted it. And why? Because that's our common law government. That's why. It's ancient. It is the longest government. No one branch has power. We're better off. But the other one, Dan, I asked him, as long as they're fighting among one another, we're pretty free, frankly. it stifles them. And that's what Madison said in the Federalist Papers. But if we go, this other fellow, he is pushing for a constitutional convention, this other lawyer. And I asked some simple questions about that, and what struck me about this fellow, and I think this is true of a lot. I talked about Islam, I talked about Judaism, and Romanism, which is fundamentally, at bottom, scholasticism. What is that? That's the worship. The worthyship, attributing worthyship, that's what worship is, it's an old word, attributing worth above fact to logic. To logic. Well, this fellow, pushing for this constitutional convention, I think he's still doing it, I just noticed that the brand of Christianity he's involved in, and it's not Romanism, it's another, it's not, well, I'll just say it's not Romanism, it's Christian, recognized as such everywhere. But the government of that particular group of people is not the government of the Bible. You know, churches govern themselves, and they'll set up a government. Fratcher, a comparative lawyer from years past, made the comment once, and I'd read his work on the subject. He said, you show me a critical mass in any nation of its religious institutions, the governments of its religious institutions, and I will show you the government of that country. I thought, well, yeah, I get it. I go down to Mexico and South America, and I see that those folks, in their heart of hearts, in their deepest convictions, they're comfortable with a dictatorship, a government of one man, one will. In their heart of hearts, it's official to them. If it's not official, it's de facto official. That is the government of their country. You know, even Mexico took on our Constitution in the year 1824. They called it the Mexican Constitution of 1824. And all of the settlers, the Anglos as they call them, that went to Texas, about 20,000 of them went there on the promise that the Mexican government would observe the Constitution of 1824, because they knew that it was substantially just like ours. The phrases and words in many places lifted right out of our Constitution. Well, that never happened. Truth is, the Constitution of 1824 of Mexico was never used. It was their official law. They never, ever used it. They couldn't. They didn't know what to do with it. Didn't mean anything to them. It was foreign to their religious point of view, you see. And so it was impossible, really, for a critical mass of them to ever use it. And they never did. Well, the same thing is true here in our country. Our government is a product of three religious groups, fundamentally. And there are some others here and there, of course. But fundamentally, the critical mass by far and away was three. And that was the Puritans of New England, the Scotch-Irish Presbyterians that were scattered throughout the colonies, and the German and Dutch Reformed groups. All three of them, theologically, the same fundamentally. There were about 3 million people, by the best figures we can obtain, about 3 million people in the colonies at that time, 1776. About 1 million of them were English Puritans and Congregationalists. A few other groups, but mostly that. About 1 million of them were Dutch and German Reformed groups. Not quite a million, a little less, but not much, over 900,000. And about 1 million of them were Scotch-Irish Presbyterians. Well, all three of them had the same kind of government. Why? Fundamentally. Why? Well, because the Bible tells people, tells the God's people what kind of government he wants them to have. And fundamentally, in first principle I'm talking about, it is not a rule of one man of one will. It is a plurality. Some churchmen call it a plurality of elders. Well, that's what the Anglo-Saxons and the Celts had. They had a plurality of elders. The Anglo-Saxons called it the Witenagemot. Witten. Witten stands for white. It means the white-bearded men, the old fellows, the elders. They were the ones that ruled, and the king in old Anglo-Saxon England back have documents, copies of documents that talk about the advice and consent of the Witenagemot. Well, that's what we have in our Constitution of the United States, the advice and consent of the elders. That comes out of the Bible. It's consistent with the Bible. It's the same kind of government. But this Constitutional Convention is, in my fundamental view, not only needless, but downright silly. The problem isn't that we're having problems with our Constitution. The problem is we're not using our Constitution. But there is an element among us, has always been, by the way, because the antagonism between the law of the land and the law of the city, the Code of Justinian, and the common law versus the civil law, spells the history of mankind. Because if two groups of people, whether or one person, or two people, or two nations, or three nations, if they cannot agree on an objective standard whereby to govern their relationship, they only have two choices. They must either, if the world's wide enough, get away from each other, or they will have to come to blows sooner or later. That's what war is all about. War is all about two different groups of people not agreeing on an objective standard whereby to govern their relationship. You see, the Constitution of the United States is one of those objective standards outside of the states of the United States upon which the states agreed would be used as the objective standard to govern the relationship, how things were to be done, not what was to be done, you see, but how things were to be done. That's our common law among the separate states of the Union. That's what the Constitution is. They agreed upon it. Magna Carta is said to be an agreement between the Crown and the landholders of England upon what the common law is, what the true law is, the law of nature on any given instance. Then they list them there in Magna Carta, how it applies. So the Constitutional Convention, it seems to me, is just downright ugly and dangerous, as though the Constitution is outdated. Listen, law, to be true law is unchangeable. The first principles of it are unchangeable. Stealing has always been against the law and will continue to be. Go ahead, Ben.
Well, no, I absolutely agree, and the thing that I would say is that my idea of a constitutional convention, an Article 5 convention, is not that it's silly, but that it's downright dangerous, because we have the same kind of mentality in this country today that is promoting Justinian law and really trying to separate it from common law. And if those same people have the ability to rewrite our Constitution, I guarantee you it won't be a simple document that the average citizen could read and understand. It will become probably a 35,000 or 50,000 page document of legalese that a bunch of damn lawyers will turn into a real mess.
Well, it'll be worse than that. I think you're right. Case in point, there's a person on the Supreme Court of the United States, as I speak, who before they became on the Supreme Court of the United States was dean of Harvard Law School. Before that, had never really practiced law to amount to anything, never really tried a case, doesn't really understand the common law, the processes of it, the new process, having not experienced it. Well, this person, when they were dean of Harvard, this has been 8-10 years ago, maybe longer, I don't remember, but it was a firestorm of upset about it when it happened. And this person said, we're going to remove the common law first-year courses and substitute international law and other kinds of law that were based upon the principles of the law of the city, the Code of Justinian, and did so. Said all the common law contracts doesn't matter. That's not really the crux of what's going on in the world today. And they removed some of those courses. That's very dangerous. But I find, too, that in such cases, of course, Harvard's a bellwether school. It used to be. I hope it isn't anymore. If somebody went to Harvard Law School, I'd think they had a screw loose at this point. They're not in touch with reality. That goes for a lot of Ivy League schools these days. And it probably won't change at this point. But the idea of getting rid of the common law is what it's all about. And to get rid of the common law, I want to mention one other thing. And this goes back to the very beginning. One of the things the evil empire, the useful idiots of it, want to destroy is masculinity, manhood, the role of the male. And it's no accident that the male is being attacked in the most vicious way. We must destroy fatherhood. We must destroy the role of the male. Why? Because the male is key to the fundamental trust settlement of God. And that's fundamental to our common law. Of course, men are important. Matter of fact, they're chiefly important in many ways. But their confidence is being eroded. And those that are rabid feminists have tried to denigrate little boys, give them Ritalin, of course, in mass, destroy their ability to have confidence to take any leadership role. We see it in our media. I'm not saying, and I'm not under any illusions, that I'm going to change that. But I do know this. I know the truth on that point, and I want to speak to the dignity of women, the dignity of marriage, and the dignity of children. The Bible says, honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Honor the king. Well, that's no different than honor all men, nothing special, just treat other men with respect. What does that mean? Bottom line, what is respect? Respect is that I don't get between you and your duty before your maker. And that's what I see the evil empire doing. Why do they do that? They do that because of this. Because in the evil empire, the Code of Justinian, the antagonist of our common law, is that some man, that the state, the government, stands in the place of God on earth. You say, well, you're getting awful religious. Well, I'm not getting religious. That's what they teach. Would we be foolish enough to say that the Nazi regime did not say that there is no appeal before beyond us? But it was in a Christian nation they said that. So they had to be careful, and they couldn't say, well, we're not God. No, no, no. The Japanese emperor could get away with saying that, and he did say that. The emperor of North Korea does say that. The only public worship allowed in North Korea is of the emperor. So they just say, yeah, we're God, because they don't have Christian sensibilities in that part of the world. But in Germany, they have that, so the ruse is this. Well, no, no, I'm not God, but God has commissioned me to stand in his place, and I have all of his power, and there's no meaningful appeal beyond me. Therefore, you have to do what I say, or I'll kill you. It's a capital crime if you don't do what I say. That, you say, oh, that's stretching it. Well, just look at history. That's not stretching it. That's what the Code of Justinian allows. This person from Russia said to me, Dan, that I was talking to, we were comparing notes and kind of, we were enjoying talking about times. But I said, well, what do the Russian people think when Boris Yeltsin, of course, all the people in America, oh, Boris Yeltsin is now, he's a freedom-loving guy, everything's going to be great. What did he do? The first thing he did was he surrounded the parliamentary building with tanks. He said, everybody's out of office. Get out of the parliamentary building. It's a one-man show until further notice. He took the reins of power, and he chained the parliamentary building shut, and he took over. I said, what did you think about it? He said, this guy said, well, that's the way it is. And when a man has to do that, that's what he has to do. Well, even if he has good intentions, that's Hitler. Let's say that Hitler had good intentions. Let's say, and we can say this, a lot of the things that Hitler did, people in Europe still like and enjoy. The people in the Netherlands, you can talk to them about it. The programs he put in place, many of them are still there. But the problem with all that is, did he make the trains run on time like Mussolini? Oh, yeah, he did all that. The problem with that is, freedom goes away. You can't make your own choices anymore. And if you disagree, he'll put piano wire around your neck and hang you. That's the problem with the Code of Justinian, because it allows government. And the terms of that code, remember, Justinian, the Roman emperor, is the one that commissioned the compiling of that Babylonian law into one place. And amazingly, he called it the Logos. Logos. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what John the Apostle calls Jesus Christ in John chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Logos. And the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. That's an important word. But they claim for their code, their Justinian's code, that it is the supreme pinnacle of human reason, perfect in elegance, perfect in beauty. Again, see, it's back to logic and reason, not fact. Back to you, Dan.
No, Brad, I have to 100% agree with what you're saying here, and certainly those that think that Christian common law can work cooperatively with Justinian law. All they need to do is read Bonhoeffer's book about how the church changed in the process of Hitler's reign, and how really they had no power at all. It was 100% Justinian law, and the trappings were there only to placate those who were Christians. That's all it was for.
Well, I can see that too. You know, oddly, and this is an odd twist of history, Martin Luther, of whom I'm a great fan, I'm fascinated with his life. I'm not a Lutheran, never have been, but I'm still fascinated with him, and I think it can be said that without Martin Luther, America might not even be here, because Martin Luther was used in such a powerful way to turn the world upside down for the right and reestablish in his own country, among his own people, the authority of the Bible by putting it in their native tongue. But Luther lived in a place called Saxony, and Saxony was one of those enclaves that the Roman law had never been able to conquer. Even the Roman legions had to back away from Saxony after Herman the German in 9 BC terminally whooped the Roman legions, slaughtered almost 20,000 of them. They went home with their tails tucked between their legs, and they never went up there again and started calling those folks barbarians. Well, they weren't barbarians in the sense they knew more Latin, a lot of them, than the Romans, and the truth, they just didn't participate in their city law system. Well, up until Martin Luther even, the Roman civil law had never taken that part of the world. And Martin Luther, when the Reformation started, he saw what was happening. He saw how Rome hated him. And he was an earthy man, there's no question, and a well-educated one on top of that. An odd combination. He didn't smell that much library dust, but he knew more than those fellows, those scholastics that shut themselves up in musty libraries and seldom took a bath. Well, Martin Luther told the electors, see, it was divided in a common law fashion. That was a common law people. Those were that was where the Anglo-Saxons were from, and the Volkreich still prevailed there, and their electorates and their provinces were divided up, and if the electors in those provinces didn't agree, it was a division of power, like in our common law system. He said to them, though, we're going to beat Rome. We're not going to beat the Code of Justinian. We're not going to beat the canon law. We're not going to beat tyranny. We're not going to beat the chokehold of the abuse of the priesthood and the money they're milking out of us unless you have the same power that Rome has. If you have the same power that Rome has, we can act quickly and we can beat them. And he talked the electors in Saxony into accepting the principles of the Code of Justinian to govern. And because of that, Bismarck was able to do what he did when he took the Code of Justinian in the year 1900, tweaked it a little bit, and put his name on it, called the Code of Bismarck. And then later, of course, the rise of Nazi Germany. That was a rise of prosperity and national pride. It was Time magazine said Adolf Hitler was the man of the year in 1938. Had his picture on the front cover. His policies brought Germany back from absolute destruction to absolute prosperity in just a couple of short years. But that doesn't mean that that's the long-range plan of our God for people. And that we don't want that to happen in America. And the reason it's happening is because we don't even allow to be taught in our law schools a subject called comparative law. It was required at one time in our law schools, comparative law. What does that mean? That means we compare the only two legal traditions of religion, law, and government that are available in the world, the law of the land and the law of the city, and we compare and contrast them. When I was in school, it was offered, and I took the course, but and learned a lot, of course. But it's not even hardly offered anymore, and it's the old thing that the evil empire does with religion and government and everything. And with everything, they say uniformity. There is no difference between religions. There is no difference between governments. There is no difference in legal system. There is no difference between men and women. And it goes on. There is no difference between black and white. Excuse me. Everybody's got something to offer. Well, that's not true. No, there is a difference. There is up and there is down. There's right and there's left. Even in the world of religion and Christianity, it says there are saints and there are ain'ts. Jesus Christ said, you either are for me or you're against me. And I could end maybe with this point, Dan. Neutrality has never been an option for mortal men. You're either for him or you're against him. And if you're for him, you're for the law of the land. You say, oh, it doesn't say that in the Bible. Yes, it does. That's the theme of the Bible, is law. How do I know that? Because God does what he does on the basis of his will, and the will of the sovereign is law. And when you look at it and you contemplate it, and I don't know everything about it, but I've been worrying over it like a dog worries over a bone for about the last 40 years, and if there's anything that I can conclude conclusively, it is that law is about land, and it's about process, how things are to be done, not specifically foremost what is to be done, but how it is to be done, because if we follow the how, we'll get to the proper what. We will. Now, that's the question. Mm-hmm. We got to ask the right question. Back to you, Dan.
Well, no, Brent, we're getting close to the end of the program. I want you to be able to talk a little bit about some of the books that you've written and how people can get more information on to talk on your website and let people know how they can get in touch with you to learn more.
Well, go to commonlawyer.com. Dan, thanks for allowing me the opportunity. Commonlawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com, and you can see there on the events button how you can participate in a class we just started. We just finished on Saturday mornings by a Skype kind of a platform. You can see me, I can't see you, a class on the law of evidence for 45 weeks, and now we're beginning a class on the law of contract. The law of promises, which relates closely to property, of course. And you can also listen to us on the radio. You can find my books at Amazon.com. Just type in my name, Brent Allen Winters. Brent Allen Winters, and they'll come up. Among those books is Excellence of the Common Law, the book you had mentioned. 958 pages, Dan. And pick out the second
one. Yeah, I guess it is.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, I'm sorry, but we've run out of time, Brent, but this has been a fascinating discussion, and I ask our listeners, please join us again next week to help us connect the dots.
It's a central bank elite bringing our destruction.